Broadway Bank, in partnership with the San Antonio Food Bank, have started their Summer Snacks for Kids campaign, providing children in low-income households with nutritious food that they lose access to during the summer. All donations go directly toward buying nutritious snacks for kids in need. Details are at broadway.bank/snacks.
I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Russia, although diminished as a nation, remains a nuclear power, and its authoritarian leader Putin continues to throw chaos into geopolitics, even to the point of interfering with U.S. presidential elections. After the fall of the Iron Curtain, there was hope that Russia could join the world as a developed nation with a thriving economy and become a beacon of freedom. Well, that didn't work out, and Putin rose to power. He set the massive country on track to have a failing economy, a losing war with Ukraine, brutal crackdowns on free speech and the press, robbing Russia of a bright future. Mark Bennett joins us, author of The Descent, Witnessing Russia's Spiral into Madness Under Putin. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. Russia did not become Vladimir Putin's Russia overnight. It was a long descent from the uncertain freedoms of the post-Soviet 1990s to the rise of a former KGB officer who promised order but built a state based on fear, shameless propaganda, brutal repression, off-the-charts corruption, and stupid war. Journalist Mark Bennett watched much of that transformation up close. He spent more than two decades reporting from Moscow, covering the tightening grip of the Kremlin, the crushing of dissent, the power of state media, and eventually Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. In his new book, The Descent, Witnessing Russia's Spiral into Madness Under Putin, he gives us a part memoir, part political history, part warning about how a society can be pushed into paranoia and how propaganda can turn lies into weapons of war. Mark Bennett joins us now. And Mark, welcome to The Source.
Hello.
It's great to
Thanks
have
for having
you.
Me.
Yeah, our phone lines are open. Listeners, give us your questions and comments about Russia, Putin, where things are going, and what lessons do you think we can learn from that? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Mark, I'm just going to jump to the big question and not work my way up to it. So my question is the Russia that we have today, was this Russia inevitable? After the fall of the Iron Curtain, were the wounds of the failure of the Soviet Union so deep? Were the cultural forces so strong of Russia that if it wasn't Putin, it would have been somebody else and we still would have ended up here? Were there opportunities to have the Russia that was developed, that would have been a partner nation to the United States and would have been a force of good and not a force of chaos?
No, it wasn't inevitable at all. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, for example, there was a Russian pro-democracy politician called Galina Staravoitova who proposed a project, who proposed lustration, which was used in other Eastern European countries after the fall of the Soviet Union, to ban former Communist Party officials, ex-KGB officers, from taking power. She proposed a ban for up to 5 to 10 years.
But she was murdered, wasn't she?
She was murdered. Firstly, she proposed this on four separate occasions. It was never approved. It never made it into law, and she was assassinated in November 1998. And with her, the idea of lustration died. But obviously, if her proposals had been accepted, if she had been successful, Then Vladimir Putin would not have been able to become president in 2000, would not have been able to succeed Boris Yeltsin, and the Russia's path would have been very different. We don't know what kind of Russia would have emerged, but it's very certain. It's certain that there would not have been the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, because it's the Russian security services who are obsessed with Ukraine. And not the pro-democracy politicians. For example, Starovoytova in 1991, after Soviet Ukraine had voted in a referendum to become independent, she took flowers to Ukraine's representative in Moscow at the time, and recalled how he was astonished. She said that, "I think they're expecting tanks, not flowers." As we know, the tanks came later. To answer your question, no, it wasn't inevitable that Russia would invade Ukraine. It wasn't inevitable that Russia would transform into what is now essentially a new totalitarian state.
Let's go to a caller, Jennifer, 833-877-8255. And Jennifer, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I have a question. In 2010, when I was in school, Medvedev was the president of Russia. And I'm just curious what prompted Putin to allow him to become president and then shortly afterwards booted him out. What was going on then?
Jennifer, thank you for your question. And Mark?
Yeah, hello, Jennifer. Thanks. In 2008, Putin came to power in 2000, and he was, according to the Constitution, he was allowed to serve for 2 4-year terms. So in 2008, his term limits were up. And he decided to sidestep this issue by allowing Medvedev to take over as president for one term, whilst he shifted to the post of prime minister. But he was still the real power. Like everybody in the country knew that Putin was pulling the strings, and Medvedev was just his hand-picked president, as it were. And then in 2012, the Kremlin argued that the Constitution referred to 2 consecutive terms as president, so there would be nothing to stop Putin coming back for another 2 terms, which and these terms were now not 4 years, as they had been initially, but they were now 6 years. Some people would say that was Medvedev's only real achievement, if that's what we can call it, and that he lengthened the presidential terms from 4 years to 6. So in 2012, Putin came back for his third term, won or secured another term in 2018. And then, of course, his term should have been up again in 2024. But in 2020, the Kremlin rewrote the Constitution to annul Putin's 2 terms and reset his term limits, as it were, in just a blatant kind of abuse of the Constitution. So they basically annulled that section of the Constitution and said that the term limits are still applicable, but just not to Vladimir Putin. This was after a Russian MP got up in Parliament and said, "We need Vladimir Putin. Without him, we are nothing. We should do something so that he can serve also more terms." So now he's allowed to stay in power until 2036, when he will be 83, if he lives that long, if he can remain in power that long. But if he does, it's more than likely that the Kremlin will find another way to extend his term limits.
Didn't Medvedev, he also approached Putin and asked if he could have a second term as president, and Putin wouldn't have it.
Yeah, he did. Medvedev was very popular when he first came to power. He was seen as this kind of great liberal, Russia's great liberal hope. He would say things like, "Freedom is better than unfreedom." So there was lots of kind of liberal rhetoric, but not much actually happened. But yeah, Medvedev wanted to run for a second term. And in an ideal world, we would have had Medvedev face off against Putin. Yeah? It would have been the Russian people's choice as to what kind of future they had wanted. Did they want a future with an ex-KGB officer? Or did they want a future with this kind of liberal-sounding guy who was promising different things?
But those liberal lines, they didn't last very long. Didn't he take a turn towards the dark side?
Well, yeah, yeah. But Putin said no, basically. And Medvedev even admitted he ran for a second term. But sometimes what a person wants to do doesn't entirely depend on them. This is the president of the country speaking. So Medvedev was booted out. And since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, he's just transformed into one of Russia's biggest hawks, regularly threatens or urges the Kremlin to drop nuclear bombs on Ukraine, Britain, America, anyone, basically.
Right. We have to remember always that Russia is a nuclear power. Oh, we're going to continue talking about Russia. We're speaking with Mark Bennett, a foreign correspondent for The Times and The Sunday Times, lived in Moscow for 25 years. We're going to continue talking about his new book, The Descent, Witnessing Russia's Spiral into Madness Under Putin. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new book, The Descent, Witnessing Russia's Spiral into Madness Under Putin. The author is with us, Mark Bennett, foreign correspondent for The Times and The Sunday Times. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I want to go back to what you were saying earlier. Someone stood up and said, you know, we can't let Putin not be president. We have to continue to keep him in office, even if it violates the Constitution. It does seem that Putin and his propaganda machine was focused on creating the impression that he was necessary, only him. He, without him, there would be no Russia. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Even one of his biggest allies, Vyacheslav Volodin, who is now the Speaker of Parliament, actually said a few years ago, if there is no Putin, there is no Russia. If there is Putin, there is Russia, which is obviously a ludicrous thing to say. But the fact that a senior politician felt that he could stand up and say this just so shows how kind of deeply embedded Putin has become into the Russian national consciousness. And Russian propaganda is very, very successful at pushing this as well. I remember in 2020 when they rewrote the constitution to allow him to stay in power for another 16 years. I had a friend, a Russian friend, who was educated in New York, speaks four languages, English, Russian, and French, and told me that there is no one but Putin who can ensure that Russia remains as a sovereign state. This is a country of 145 million people. So if it's able to affect educated people who have lived in the West, then you can just imagine what it's doing to kind of uneducated people who stare at television all day long and don't really have much contact with the outside world. Kremlin propaganda is insanely effective and insanely frightening.
Yeah, so that's one of the principles of authoritarian rule is the ruler. There is no difference between the ruler, the individual, tends to be a man, the man and the state, the nation. Mm-hmm. They're all the same. And mm-hmm. We can see that in your book, The Descent, because we're seeing Russia's spiral into madness under Putin, because he is spiraling himself. Extreme paranoia. Mm-hmm. His aggression, he wants himself to expand to become greater. So Russia has to expand and become greater. And these mm-hmm. moves and the extreme corruption that is underway as well. Mm-hmm. So what is Putin's state right now? Today he's in, Kazakhstan? Mm-hmm. Russia seems to be moving towards more aggressive action to Baltic states. You wonder what's happening, what's going to happen next to Moldova. There's a lot happening. It's not just Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not just Ukraine, but Putin is obsessed with Ukraine primarily. I think it's difficult sometimes for people who haven't lived in Russia or don't really follow it to understand just how deeply I mean, I think the word mad is appropriate here, how the things have become in Russia and Putin's inner circle. For example, recently, one of Putin's closest allies, a man called Yuri Kovalchuk, told the Forum of teachers, of senior teachers in Moscow, that the West is developing a deadly virus that will wipe out most of humanity and leave only a small elite left whose needs will be serviced by AI robots. Putin himself has pushed in just insane conspiracy theories. One of them is that Madeleine Albright said, Madeleine Albright thinks that it's wrong that Russia owns Siberia, that it should be broken up and given to other countries, i.e. America. There's no record of Madeleine Albright actually having said this. And eventually it emerged that this idea that Albright had said this came from a Kremlin psychic team who during the 1990s had stared at a photograph of Madeleine Albright and divined that she was thinking this. And Putin picked up on this, and he repeats it all the time. Some American officials and the other Russian propaganda says, Madeleine Albright, for example, thought that Siberia should be broken up. I mean, you can just go on and on and on. But I think that Putin will just keep fighting in Ukraine because, A, he doesn't, he still thinks that, he still insanely thinks that many Ukrainians want Russia to rule, as bizarre and absurd as that sounds, and also that it's something which has shaped his entire, kind of most of his modern life, most of his adult life, sorry, is that Ukraine should be part of Russia again. And then we get this kind of echo chamber with Kremlin television, state propaganda, which takes its messaging directly from Putin. I mean, he's not calling them every day and say this, but they know what kind of things they have to push. And then Putin, as we know, watches state media, watches state television. So it's like an echo chamber where Putin is trapped in this. And he and his cronies, in ex-KGB cronies, are influencing what state media says, which then amplifies the message back to them. And it just goes on and on and on in this insane circle of violence and just insanity. For example, one of the staples of Russian propaganda is that people in Europe, children in Europe aren't allowed to call their parents mother and father. They have to call them parents number one and parents number two. And you'd be surprised how many Russians actually believe this. They think it's true. They think children can't say mom or dad. They have to say parent number one, parent number two, bring me my food, please. So yeah, I mean, it's not a rational leadership.
So Ukraine, the war is going badly right now for Russia. Ukraine mm-hmm. is gaining territory that it had. It's recapturing territory. Moscow is being hit by drone rockets, bombs. This is the first time that Moscow has felt this type of attack since World War II. And definitely they're losing more people in the Russian military than they're able to now recruit. So have they recognized in Moscow, in Russia, the general population that the war is not going well and that this has been a big mistake?
I think the general public realizes that it's not going well. People within the Russian elite have known for a while that it's not going very well. Some pro-Kremlin analysts are even trying to push the idea that it's not going well. But the only person who really matters right now is Putin. And he shows no signs at all that he is willing to withdraw troops. People are amplifying some throwaway comments that he said, for example, recently said, this matter is coming to an end. And everyone jumped on and said, oh, Putin said the war's going to end soon. But it's not really even clear what he was talking about. He might have actually been talking about Western aid or Ukraine, or he might just have been repeating his belief again that Russia is on the verge of a crushing victory. In my view, he'll continue fighting for as long as he can. I think he'll continue fighting until there's either a revolution, until he dies, or until he physically can't do it anymore because Russia doesn't have any troops left. Of course, his kind of window for a deal is closing fast. Yeah, I mean, if President Trump loses the midterms, then he's not going to be as powerful, and it's going to be hard for him to force Ukraine into a deal that will be beneficial to Russia. So that's, I think, why we're seeing. I mean, Moscow is being bombed, but Russia has also ramped up its bombardment of Kiev recently, and is threatening kind of unprecedented strikes in the next few days. So these are dangerous times, and this is a moment of escalation in a war that's been going on for over 4 years now, and has cost something like, UK intelligence said that 500,000 Russian soldiers had died. Ukrainian casualties are probably around 150, deaths are probably around over 100,000 to be sure. So this is a violent, deadly, senseless war that just looks set to grind on, as far as I can tell.
Right. And that prospect, people in Russia, the elites are seeing that that Putin has dug in and he is unwilling to actually consider ending the war on Ukraine's terms, which would mean like complete withdrawal and including Crimea. But they want the war to end because they see the sanctions, the bombings, everything else, the loss of the internet. These things are happening because of the war. And they see this is not good for Russia's future. Russia has lost its future, and it's just going to get more grim the longer the war continues. And they may feel like they may have to force a change of leadership with Putin. And he's grown so paranoid about all of this. So is this coming to, but thinking that there will be some sort of coup or an attempt to remove Putin seems like this is not something that the Russians would actually tolerate because of how much they have been groomed into believing that he is the state.
No, I don't agree with that at all. If Putin was deposed tomorrow, the Russian people, It's very difficult. Most people just accept Putin as kind of a fact of nature by now. Yeah, but there's a great apathy as well at the heart of Russia. No one will die for Putin, as we saw, for example, when Yevgeny Prigozhin, the Wagner chief, the Wagner mercenary boss, launched an armed rebellion against Moscow.
Putin's cook.
Yeah, Putin's cook. No one went out on the streets. There were no human kind of shields formed around the Kremlin. And even soldiers just stood aside.
They cheered him.
Some of them, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's a very complicated issue. I don't think that... Also, I mean, if Putin is deposed, then Russian propaganda, being so effective, would switch on and tell everyone that Putin lied to you, Putin led you into a catastrophic war, and essentially within a year, probably, he would probably be the most hated man in Russia.
They'll have school children singing on television what a horrible man Putin was.
Well, probably, yeah.
They have school kids singing now how great it is that there is no internet.
Yeah. Well, that was one show, and but that was very North Korean style. I don't know. I mean, the before the war, at least, the common response to people in Russia, when you would point out to them that Putin is a crook and a killer and et cetera, and a dictator, they would say, but if not Putin, then who? Which isn't exactly a kind of a glowing endorsement, yeah? It's like, so we don't have anyone else. Or... they would say, yeah, but we need a kind of iron fist because we remember the 1990s and the failure of democracy, which brought massive poverty to Russia, a crime wave, and it was just a very grim time for everyone concerned. Of course, when Putin took power in 2000, prices for oil rocketed, and the living standards logically increased. But most people don't really analyze it that deeply. They just see that during Yeltsin's reign, they lived badly. Putin came to power. They started to live better.
But now we're seeing the standards of living in Russia fall. People are poorer today than they were a year ago.
That's true. But there's still, a lot of it depends on Moscow. Yeah, Moscow is Russia's richest city. And while... people in Russia are also suffering economically as well. We shouldn't exaggerate the depth of this suffering. I mean, they're not there are not bread queues like in the late Soviet period. The supermarkets are full. The restaurants are full. You can ignore the war. Moscow is being hit, but it's not being hit on a daily basis. And these aren't ballistic missiles crashing into Red Square. These are drones that have hit a few high rise flats. They can manage through, yeah, in Moscow. There was an interesting article today in the Moscow Times, which is an English language mm-hmm. website, which was kicked out of Russia and is now banned by the Kremlin. And they were looking at what people on Russian social media were talking about, and it's all like holidays, travel, restaurants, films they like. Very few mentions of the war still.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back. I want to dig in more about writing about your life when you were living in Russia before you were tossed out. The book is The Descent, Witnessing Russia's Spiral into Madness Under Putin. Journalist Mark Bennett is here. We'll come back with your questions. Call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Russia is not the center of the geopolitical universe. It is kind of a side character these days, and that is a fact that really irritates Putin, the dictator of Russia. And he wants Russia to be restored to all of its former glory, made a superpower, and really interfere with the United States and all other democracies, Western civilization style. So what is happening there? How did we get here? We're joined by Mark Bennett. He is the author of the book, The Descent, Witnessing Russia's Spiral into Madness Under Putin. So, Mark, you lived in Russia for more than two decades. When you got there, I mean, when you went there, I guess, to become an English teacher, what did you see Russia as a country that was up and coming, and that you wanted to be part of that? What country did you think you were joining?
Well, I arrived in Russia in January 1997, and while Russians were arguably freer than at any time in their history to say what they wanted and to read what they wanted and to express opinions that they wanted to do, the country had massive economic problems. Poverty was widespread, crime was widespread, and there basically didn't seem to be any kind of control or any kind of rule of law at all. I remember in 1998, I went to a party at a Russian nuclear power station where a friend of mine was a friend of mine's girlfriend was working, and at some point in the evening, two truckers turned up with nuclear waste in the back of their vehicle, and they found out that I can't drive, and they decided to teach me there and then. So kind of after having drunk quite a lot, so we were just driving around the perimeter of this nuclear power station. Which just kind of underlined to me just how anarchic Russia was at that point. So no, I mean, I didn't really think Russia was on the up. It wasn't. I mean, it wasn't really until the 2000s, during Putin's first term, that the economy really took off. But that was to do with mainly to do with the spike in oil prices, which gave Putin's budget, which was a real boost to Putin's budget.
Let's go to a caller, Jose. The number is 833-877-8255. And Jose, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm enjoying the demise of Russia, according to you guys.
It's not according to us. It's happening.
No, it's not. It would be nice that we don't have this disagreement, if you would have somebody to counter, at least coming from the Russian perspective, but that may be too much to ask. In any case, Putin is in a position that we've put him in, and he's treading cautiously because he knows that if he prosecutes this war to Russia's true capability, all right, that may trigger a nuclear confrontation between NATO and Russia. So he's really being put in a bind here. And he's doing well by Russia by approaching this cautiously. He's being responsible, the adult in the room. The Russians also are, if they're suffering, it's due to American sanctions, and yet they know how to navigate through that. They are right now incensed. They want to go in, and they want Russia, they want Putin to go in and really throttle up this war and get it over with at any cost, because they are angry. All right. They're not just angry at Putin. They're angry at the fact that the war should have been done with by now. And the thing is, they don't realize, a lot of Russians just don't realize that you just can't prosecute the war the way they can. They have to be cautious. Otherwise, the repercussions may be catastrophic.
Jose, are you done? Did you get your say in?
I'm done.
All right. All right. So, Jose, thank you for your call. Mark Bennett's your response.
I've been to Ukraine 15 times since the war started. And I can tell you, on the ground, it does not look like Russia is being cautious. There are missiles flying everywhere. There are drones flying everywhere. I've been to torture chambers where former torture chambers where people have told me how they were raped, assaulted by Russian troops. I've seen schools that have been hit by missiles, kindergartens that have been hit by missiles. So I'm not too sure why you think Russia is being cautious. Just the other night, I was texting with my friend in Kiev whilst ballistic missiles were slamming into Kiev. So the caution that you talk about, it's not really clear what caution you're talking about here. I don't really understand why you think the West put Putin in this position. Ukraine still hasn't been invited to join NATO. And that's largely because the West was terrified of a nuclear war with Russia. Putin said on the eve of the war that the West was planning an attack on Russia from Ukraine. If that was the case, why didn't the Biden administration, I mean, forget about the Trump administration, but why didn't the Biden administration then launch the attack after Russia had invaded Ukraine? It would have had the perfect opportunity and you would argue excuse to do so if that was its true intention.
So to the first point that Jose made about Russia, we're being unfair when we're saying that Russia is in decline or a demise of Russia. Is that an objective assessment of the state of Russia?
Demise in what sense?
I mean, it seems like economically we know that Russia is...
Well, economically, Russia is suffering.
Geopolitically,
economically, Russia is suffering. Demographically, Russia is suffering because Putin has sacrificed at least 325,000 Russian men to the war. 325,000 Russian men to the war. These are people who have died. Yeah, tens of thousands of people who have come home with no limbs. So, in that sense, yeah, Russia is declining. The economy is struggling. As I said, it's not as bad as some people in the West would have you believe. But it's certainly worse than it was when the war started. You've had hundreds of thousands, up to a million Russians have fled the country because of the war, because they know if they say anything against it, they will be sent to prison for up to 15 years, which is the maximum punishment now for spreading fake news about the war in Ukraine. And the youngest political prisoner I know of in Russia is a 15-year-old boy who was arrested in 2024 for putting leaflets into his neighbor's mailboxes, which criticized Putin and the war. He was given a 5-year prison sentence. These don't sound like the actions of a great nation to me. In that sense, I don't think that Russia is on the up, no?
So Russia could end the war today. All it has to do is just return to its sovereign borders.
Of course, Russia could end the war, yeah, this afternoon.
And, and Ukraine, it's not going to surrender, particularly now that it is doing so well.
Well, Zelensky has already said that he recognizes that Russia now controls large sections of the Donbass, and he would be willing to freeze the conflict. That would entail surrendering to at least two major cities in the east, the city of Donetsk and the city of Luhansk. And he said, we will try and return these later through diplomatic means. So Zelensky has already said that he's willing to give up this territory, or at least de facto give up this territory, right? This is territory in the east of Russia that where Putin claims to be fighting Nazis who have been persecuting the Russian-speaking population. It's a fact. It's a fact. This is a fact. This is a fact that you can find on the website of the occupying authorities in the Donetsk region, that 7 people died as a result of military hostilities in 2021, the year before Putin ordered his invasion. 5 people died in 2020. On the very first day of the invasion, at least 7 people were killed in the same region. And now, of course, the death toll of ethnic Russians in the area that Putin claims to be defending is off the scale. It's in thousands, at least. And the entire towns have been wiped from the face of the earth. For example, Putin claims to be defending, to have liberated the town of Bakhmut. I've been to Bakhmut. There's nothing left. It's gone. There's nothing there at all. This doesn't sound like a very effective way of liberating someone or defending them.
Do you think that Putin could use nuclear weapons?
Yes.
And,
yeah, I do. I think he would use nuclear weapons. That's the problem. Right now in the war, Russia isn't winning. Ukraine isn't winning either. Neither of them are losing or winning. It's a grinding draw. Ukraine is causing Russia a lot of pain. But to actually defeat Russia, it's not even clear what we mean. How do you defeat Russia? They're not going to force the Russians out of all of Ukraine. They're not going to march on Moscow. Any kind of crushing kind of strategic defeat for Russia that puts Putin's personal safety at risk, i.e. by provoking coup or in any other way, I think he would respond to that with the use of tactical nuclear weapons to try and escalate, to de-escalate, as the saying goes, and by forcing Ukraine and the West to accept a peace on his terms. I have no doubt at all that if it came to it, Putin would use nuclear weapons. Maybe not strategic nuclear weapons. I don't think he wants to start a third world war. But he could easily use tactical nuclear weapons. And then once you've used those, then the kind of the taboo against the use of nuclear missiles that's lasted since 1945, since America bombed Japan, has been broken, right? So yeah. Then
I don't know how you can use any nuclear weapon and not trigger a third world war, but we'll talk about that some more. I'm going to get 2 callers on the air. We got JD and Norman. And if you want to jump in, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we are talking about Russia, their military capacity, what's happening with Russia as a nation and the people. Give us a call, 833-877-8255. We'll be right back with The Descent, witnessing Russia's spiral into madness under Putin, right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies. Mark Bennett is with us, a foreign correspondent for The Times and The Sunday Times. His new book is The Descent, witnessing Russia's spiral into madness under Putin. Let's go to a caller, JD. And JD, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes. Hi, JD. You're on the air.
Yes. I was just wanting to ask him if he saw any similarity between Putin and what Trump is doing nowadays.
All right, JD, thank you for the question. What are your thoughts? Do you think that Trump has learned a few things from Putin?
That's a good question. And it's something that actually Russian opposition journalists who have been forced to flee their own country have spoken about, how shocked they have been by how quickly Trump has been using kind of Putin's playbook, trying to crack down on the media, establishing a kind of cult of personality, or trying to do, going against journalists. it's unclear if Trump is directly influenced by Putin. But there are some remarkable similarities. For example, Putin calls the war in Ukraine a special military operation, and Trump said recently, it's not a war in Iran, it's a military operation, which was hardly the most original comment.
Yeah, also, so Putin did things deliberately where he would cause chaos, and then he would come in and be the solution and use that as an opportunity to consolidate power. And I've heard things like Bannon talk about a muzzle velocity and flood the zone and cause chaos, and that and the Republican Party would do the same thing. So is that
Bannon actually met Alexander Dugin, who's who's a kind of a Russian ultra-nationalist thinker whose books have influenced at least some members of the Russian political and maybe Russian military and maybe political elites. We don't know how much influence he has, but we do know that Bannon met him and they discussed tactics, as it were. We do know that some people close to members of the Trump administration have read Dugin and admire him. We know this for a fact. I think that some of the Kremlin's thinking is definitely seeping into the way the Trump administration sees the world.
Let's go to another caller, Norman. And Norman, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. My comment was that, like, I know, Russia, right, state of war and stuff like that, and we're judging them to be on the decline, but, I mean, they are in a state of war. Like, if the U.S. had gone through a similar war, I mean, I guess our equivalency would be like Iraq on our borders, we would be experiencing the effects much more acutely versus the way we did halfway around the world. Not to mention the Ukraine has been culturally, I mean, it's a bigger part of Russia. So I just think unfairly saying that they're on the decline is just, you know, I would say they're going through a tough spot. Yes, you know, it is war, but like, it's just.
And do you think it was a necessary war? Do you think that Russia needed to invade Ukraine?
See, I mean, this is from their perspective, right? Like, they're a superpower. What would be our equivalent? Our equivalent would be like someone stepping in Mexico, or if Mexico's trying to join Russia or something like that. I don't know. It's a very terrible war, and I agree. It's stupid. You were right when you called it stupid in the beginning. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, Norman, thank you for calling in. Okay, and get your reaction, Mark.
I mean, firstly, Ukraine isn't a part of Russia, has never been a part of Russia. It was a part of the Soviet Union, and it hasn't been since 1991. The point about Mexico is often made by Kremlin, pro-Kremlin analysts who say, how would the United States react if Russia, for example, moved troops into Mexico? But there were no troops. There were no foreign troops in Ukraine. There was no foreign buildup of troops on Russia's border. Ukraine wanted to be a part of NATO, but then you also have to ask yourself why it wanted to be a part of NATO, because it felt the threat from Russia. Like many, many former Soviet countries, it wanted to be independent. It didn't want to be ruled by Moscow anymore. It wanted an element of democracy or freedom. And it saw NATO as a shield against this. And as I said earlier, there was no indication at all that NATO was going to attack Russia because it's terrified of its nuclear arsenal. Why would NATO suddenly attack Russia and trigger the Third World War? And if it wanted to do so, why hasn't it done so already? Why didn't it do so after Russia began attacking Ukraine? As I said again, the Biden administration was terrified that the war in Ukraine would start World War III. And that's probably why, it is why he didn't give Ukraine enough weapons to inflict a crushing kind of blow against Russia. He gave them enough to defend themselves and really no more. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really understand why people think Russia had no choice. I mean, of course it had a choice.
It was a bad choice, obviously, because it was
What would have happened if Russia hadn't invaded Ukraine in 2022? What would have happened to Russia? I mean, there would be 350,000 young Russian men who would still be alive. The Russian economy wouldn't be struggling. Hundreds of thousands of people wouldn't have fled the country. And what exactly has Russia achieved in the war? It now controls 20% of Ukraine, but a lot of that it controlled before 2022. For example, Crimea and large chunks of eastern Ukraine. It's seen Sweden and Finland join NATO, which they weren't NATO members before the war started, and they had no desire to join NATO, but they saw that Russia invaded Ukraine, and obviously they thought, okay, we need to be part of NATO as well. So it's kind of very hard to see why Putin felt he had no choice, and very hard to see what he's achieved for Russia. As again, it's solely because Putin was driven out of his mind, probably during the coronavirus pandemic, when he spent all of his time in isolation with his hardline KGB allies, discussing, debating Ukraine, and then came up with this quote-unquote genius plan to try and invade Kiev.
I'm going to go to another caller, Elaine. Elaine, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm listening to what's going on, and I'm thinking with us Americans, we're calling the kettle black, saying bad things about Putin. We've got an insane person running our country, and yet people just stand there and put up with it. And he's got his own oligarch of all of his little rich cronies, including his own sons. So that's sad that we don't see, we wear these blinders and we don't see what he's leading us into. The first ones that should be on the front line are his three boys. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Elaine. Let's talk about Putin's corruption.
Well, can I respond to that?
Yeah, go ahead. I think it's similar, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Trump is doing very similar things, but I'm not an American, so you need to sort that one out yourself.
Yeah. I mean, so the United States sent a Tomahawk missile into a school in Iran. Mm-hmm. And so as people are saying that, how much personal responsibility should I have for that act?
Well, yeah, that's exactly the kind. That's what I always ask people when they start talking about the collective responsibility of the Russian nation for the war crimes. Then I ask them, is every single American responsible for the death of over 100 schoolgirls in Iran? I don't think you're responsible. Same as I don't think every single Russian. I think the Russians who do support the war, they are responsible. It's individual responsibility. But I don't hold every American responsible for the deaths of those girls.
But we've seen, so part of Putin's deal is his corruption. He's reportedly to be, compared to Elon Musk, but he was the richest man in the world before Elon Musk became so wealthy. Billions and billions of dollars socked away. All these oligarchs had to pay him. So was that part of his psychological makeup that he needed to amass all that wealth?
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear how much kind of money he has, but in one sense, he doesn't even need money, yeah, because the whole country is his. What does he need money for? It's not as if he's paying for things, yeah. He has residences dotted around the country, luxury residences that he visits like once or twice a year. And his family members are insanely rich. But I think, yeah, I mean, this kind of idea that you have to grab as much money as you can, that doesn't really matter how you do it, it again came out of from the 1990s, in a sense, not only, but I mean, it's probably part of his kind of psychological makeup as well. But he, like a lot of Russians, appears to have been poor in the 1990s. I mean, he claims to have worked as a taxi driver, not an official taxi driver, but in Russia after the breakup of the Soviet Union, people would drive around their cities or towns after work and just pick up people who were looking for rides. So you put your hand out, within like a couple of minutes, someone would pull up, and it could be anyone. It could be a physicist on his way home from the institute. It could be a soldier on leave. It could be an ambulance. I remember an ambulance stopping for us once. And you'd pay them some cash, and they would take you where you wanted to go. Putin said, like, I was even forced to do this. And people in the West laughed. But I don't know. I mean, it may have been true. We don't know how much he did it. But I think his experience of poverty in the 1990s.
You think, I'm really out of time here, but real quickly, you think he'll ever go back to Russia?
Well, I'd like to. I spent a very long time there.
I bet you miss it.
I miss it, yeah. I'm not sure I entirely want to go back right now because it would be...
Because you wouldn't last very long. You'd probably fall off a building pretty quickly.
They've banned reporting the truth, essentially. So,
It's
possible to report there from there right now. Just you have to get a visa and there are technical reasons why I can't go back.
After this book, I don't know. Mark Bennett's, his book is The Descent, Witnessing Russia's Spiral into Madness Under Putin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.